This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us every day at freeenergynews.com. And if you want to tune in for calling in to see the numbers, go to freeenergynow.net. Our guest today is Jeff Tester. He is a professor of chemical engineering at MIT. He directed MIT's Energy Lab for many years, and we are very honored to have him on our show today. He just produced a document. It's about 400 pages, which is going to be the premier document about geothermal energy. This actually came out and was featured in many, many mainstream news organizations, from Nature to New York Times to Boston Globe. I mean, it's just like hundreds of international news organizations covered the story of the release of this premier document on geothermal energy. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thank you, Sterling.
Well, do you feel like you just had a baby?
Well, I'm not so sure of that. First of all, this was hardly my singular effort. We had an 18-member group of highly qualified people that we brought together to carry out this study for a period of 15 months. So not all of that adds up to one baby, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, I know, you know, I've been trying to get you on this show for many months, and you've been saying, well, wait until we get this thing published, and then we'll do it. And you finally got her out. You've been wanting to get this out for, since what, last November or so?
Right. I guess we learned the lesson that the document was printed in a fairly high-quality form, which took some time of going through proofs and things, but we also wanted to allow enough time for serious peer review by experts that represented around the world. Department of Energy also carried out an independent peer review for us. They were the sponsor of this study.
Great. Well, now this thing is out. What is it about geothermal that this is bringing to light that maybe we didn't know or appreciate beforehand? I mean, geothermal is not new. It's been around as an energy source internationally for many years. The U.S. has been leading this in terms of the number of kilowatt hours. What does this document bring to light that we didn't really appreciate or know before?
Well, I think many individuals tend to think of geothermal as being very localized and therefore perhaps too small to make a difference on a large national scale. We have very high-grade natural resources in the western part of the U.S., and they're being utilized extensively. As you mentioned, we have the largest, from a country point of view, the largest production of geothermal produced electricity around in the world. The technology for doing that has evolved at least over the past 100 years, when the first field started in northern Italy. But what I think people begin to think is that it must be too limited. It must be only present, therefore, where nature has been kind enough to us to put all the ingredients together, and it's just not going to work where we might need it in other parts of the country, because these coincidences of nature just aren't ready and accessible near the surface. So what our study tried to do was to actually go back over an old concept that had been around for about a quarter of a century that now is termed EGS, standing for Enhanced Geothermal Systems. And the basic idea is actually quite simple. What we're trying to do is to emulate or reproduce what nature has provided in these localized sites in Iceland and New Zealand, Northern California, and Northern Italy, in a manner that would produce hot water or steam at rates that could commercially compete with generating power in today's energy markets. And we looked first at the size of the resource and its distribution around the country, and then at the technology, particularly the last 30 years or so of that technology as it's evolved as a result of field testing at a number of major sites around the world.
Give us an idea of how many kilowatt hours geothermal is providing in comparison to, say, solar or hydro.
Right. It's important to, for the U.S., I assume you're thinking.
Actually, U.S. and then worldwide.
Right. I have better figures on in my head for the U.S., but worldwide I think we could make some estimates. In the United States, we produce about 3,000 megawatts, so that would be 3 million kilowatts, but let's probably use megawatts. It's a little easier number to deal with, of geothermal electricity. And that electricity is provided on essentially a continuous basis, so that the so-called capacity or availability factor of a geothermal plant is quite high. Over 90% is typical. So when we compare it with solar or hydro, we have to keep in mind that the capacity factor of those two resources could be quite a bit lower. The United States produces of the order of about 500 or so megawatts of solar power, I believe, that you could consider to be base-loaded or on the grid, and primarily that comes from one major site in Southern California, a site called Cramer Junction, where they use parabolic trough technology to generate the power. Of course, there are many photovoltaic installations on individual homes and somewhat larger things, but very few of those are really connected to the grid in the same way that a large hydroelectric plant or geothermal plant would be. Hydro, of course, is a major player in the United States as well as in Canada and other countries. We have about 75,000 megawatts or so of installed capacity of hydro at a number of sites scattered in the west, in the east, in the southern part of the country, and also in the northeast. And in addition to that, hydro also has a very vital role to play in terms of energy storage, because there's a considerable amount of pumped hydro storage that can be dispatched when it's needed. If you added both of those together, that would be over 100,000 megawatts. And that's exactly the idea that we put together when the panel first met, which was, how could we imagine a situation where geothermal could grow in the U.S., could grow from where it is today, which is about 3,000 megawatts, to being as large as, let's say, the hydropower capacity we have, which is also comparable to the nuclear capacity we have in the country as well, roughly 100,000 megawatts. So from 3 gigawatts to 1,000 or to 100 gigawatts is a big step, and it requires a large resource, and it will require the development of technology beyond the state it's at right now.
And what year are you projecting that could be done by under reasonable circumstances?
Right. Well, what another big part of this study or assessment was to very carefully review the 30 years or so of research that has gone on around the world. There have been five major field tests. The first started in New Mexico at the Los Alamos Lab, a site called Fenton Hill, back in the 1970s. It went on for quite some time. And then there was another major experiment or field test that was done in Cornwall, England, at the Rosmanalis site. And that was followed by a number of other activities in Japan at two different locations. And then a major one in Europe, which is actually still ongoing, that is funded by the European Union, and then one, you know, that's still very active in Cooper Basin. So it might seem like we know an awful lot about how to do this, and what we found was that In fact, the technical feasibility, the idea of pumping water into the ground and opening up a fracture system and connecting it to a set of wells, has been well established, actually, at all of those sites. The difficulty is so far that we haven't really been able to produce these long enough and at high enough rates of production that would be considered to be commercially viable. And there's a number of reasons for that, and that's part of what we did in this assessment, was to look carefully at the lessons learned by that 30 years of field testing and to try to map out the remaining technical issues and what it might cost in the way of invested research and invested field investments and field programs to bring that to fruition in a relatively short period of time.
To put it in maybe a somewhat of a, not vulgar, but very, maybe, would you consider this report as having been somewhat of a logjam breaker in terms of identifying the technical issues that have kept geothermal from moving forward and starting to move this logjam so that we can get some flow here? Is that a fairly good analogy?
Well, I think, there's a lot to be learned when you have a talented group, as we had for this panel. Many of the individuals on the panel had been with those projects early on, including myself back at the Fenton Hill project. But we never really had sat down and looked at it in this way. And I think that, you know, it's 2020 hindsight is always perfect, as you can imagine, Sterling, but there are many reasons, perhaps, why the progress wasn't as fast as we would like, or at least as advocates of the technology. And some of that has to do with just the reality of carrying out field work when let's say, bits and pieces of the hardware or technology really aren't ready yet to give you the kind of information you need to know about the structure and let's say to optimize the methods under which you're going to create this connectivity under the ground. Drilling is always a risky business, and when we drill it at higher temperatures in environments that haven't been really studied very carefully before, as was the case some 30 years ago, there was a lot to be learned. Engineers tend to learn, as you can imagine, by making mistakes and correcting them and being creative, and an awful lot of that did happen in the early years of the project. But what we saw, particularly if we looked at the later field work at Sault in Sault, France, that was multiply supported by a number of European countries in the European Commission or European Union, we found that they were able to build on the early experiments and the technology that had evolved, starting at Fenton Hill and Rosamund Alice and the Japanese experiments, and were able to produce a large reservoir, and by using directional drilling techniques and other new technologies that had been evolving naturally during the course of that 30 years because of oil and gas developments and other drilling work that had been going on, they were able to get very close, much closer than the earlier studies had been able to do, to this kind of commercial production goal. And we were encouraged by that, both with respect to the size of the reservoir, which is important for the maintaining a long lifetime of production. You're investing all the cost in capital costs in the very early phases of this project before you produce any power, so you want it to last a while. And we're encouraged that we could get quite close to a commercial system with just a little bit more technology development. And the plan for that was to get serious about it in the country and to have multiple tests go on sequentially over, say, the course of 10 to 15 years, which would be very different than the earlier testing that had gone on by various government and state agencies. It would be a multi-year commitment and not necessarily just a year-to-year operation. And we think that the panel, I think, feels that's necessary to sort of stay the course for a while. We evaluated what it might cost to do that and feel that it's actually quite reasonable when you look at the other alternatives. So, yes, it's a logjam to a certain extent, but geothermal is not alone here. Virtually every other alternative energy technology has had to sort of suffer with the ups and downs of funding support, difficulties associated with parts of their technology, or the risk associated with commercial development, you name it. They've all been there for almost every type of renewable technology over the course of the past 30 years.
Do you think that the breaking of this logjam in terms of getting the necessary funding behind this and expertise will come from the private sector, or is it going to require government support?
Well, I think our view is at this stage, particularly when we look at how the private sector finances major energy projects, this is a lot different than just putting photovoltaics on the roof of a house, or even deploying them on larger buildings, or even putting in wind turbines, because the initial investment, because the size of the plant is larger. So even though the cost on a per kilowatt basis might be comparable to some of these others, in fact it's a little less than solar photovoltaics, but it's, and perhaps a little larger than wind at this point, but it the scale of the project is typically in the range of tens of megawatts of electricity or greater per plant, and that means you've got to raise a major amount of capital if you're going to do this privately. And our feeling is that the risk, the both real and perceived risk that would be associated with the early adopters of the first-generation plants would be too high to find necessarily total private investment in this. Even for good geothermal areas right now in the western part of the United States, there need to be some incentives provided to bring those projects to fruition, including taking advantage of production tax credits, renewable portfolio standards, and other financial instruments that might help reduce the risk in the eyes of a bank or an individual group of investors. So we don't think that's any different here, except it's even at a little bit earlier stage of development. So the government, whether it's state, federal, or some combination, would probably have to make a major investment in the early deployment of the technology. And we envision that as being done in a number of ways. We actually calculated through a series of economic models what the absorbed cost might be for deploying the first few plants, which would develop the technology, put us on a learning curve to improve it, and the sort of combination of learning by doing and taking advantage of improved technology by supported research and development, we feel pretty strongly that that would take us to within the period of 10 to 15 years to an enterprise where they would just be financed by the private sector. So there is a path to get there pretty quickly.
It would seem like a natural symbiotic organization that has already got the infrastructure and technical capability would be the oil industry. They're routinely popping holes in the ground,
right,
and I would think they're even bumping into hotspots.
You're absolutely right.
Do you think that there are some politics involved in why they're not interested in geothermal? Or it would seem like that would be just a natural secondary product for them. I would envision a company like Shell, for example, whose purpose is to, you know, they've got the huge infrastructure, they've got the huge capital, and they've got the capability to go in and make these tests and finance them and develop the technology. Why is that not happening?
Well, this is an excellent question, and it probably is going to require a couple of different answers. First of all, I think historically the oil and gas industry has been involved in geothermal development. The entire sort of early rollout of the Geysers field in California and other developments in California were carry out technologically and with financial investment by Union Oil, then becoming Unocal. And so you're absolutely right. There's a tremendous match of the aspects that you need, both financial capability, the fact that they are used to accepting high risk, that they put a lot of their own equity capital into the drilling and exploration phases of oil and gas development. And I think if you look back again over that 30-year period that we examined the technology of EGFs as part of this assessment, you'll find that there have been major oil companies involved with geothermal, both in terms of cooperative work with the government as well as their own privately funded enterprises, including Shell. Shell was actively involved in Central America and also with the European Union project at Sulz. Chevron and other major oil companies have been involved with it. So I think it does ultimately fit their business plan quite well and would be aligned perfectly for adoption, let's say, by either acquisition or evolution towards geothermal. However, the question still is, why aren't they doing it more now? And I think that they have kind of a full menu at this point with respect to oil and gas exploration and development around the world, and there is plenty of activity going on, as you know, and they're making a fair amount of money doing this given the commodity situation with oil prices right now. So there's really no incentive, I think, on their part is to go into yet another, which might be perceived risky business, when they don't really need to yet. But our feeling on the panel is that this is actually a positive feature about geothermal, because if we're going to develop it to the level of 100,000 megawatts, it's always a relevant question to ask, well, where will the industry be? Will we have to create a whole new industry, a whole new infrastructure to carry this out? And I think in this case, it's a very logical short-term evolution from the entire oil and gas exploration and production business as it goes on right now in North America and other parts of the world. So that's a good thing. The bad thing is they're not more active in it right now.
The thing that first brought my attention to your work was an article that was published about some shallow geothermal capabilities that we don't have to go really, really deep to get the kind of heats that we need. And with the arrival or the emergence of technologies that are able to harness or convert low-level heat into electricity, it becomes much more feasible to have a more shallow well as opposed to a deep one, making geothermal much more feasible. Maybe you could talk about that for a minute.
Right. I'll jump onto that in a second, but I also want to point out one important thing that Dave Blackwell was a member of the panel, and he has been a leader in looking at the potential for going after fairly low temperature fluids that are co-produced with oil and gas production. And as you correctly pointed out, Sterling, earlier, that the oil and gas industry, even in just producing oil and gas, uses a lot of water. And some of these oil and gas wells are quite deep and they're fairly hot. So there's a fair amount of hot water that's co-produced along with the production of oil and gas. And Dave Blackwell's group at SMU and has looked at this pretty carefully, and we incorporated that as a part of this study because we felt it was very short-term, easily accessible. You don't have to drill new holes for this to start with. All you have to do is utilize the hot water that's being produced at the surface. So that made a lot of sense. So I think it forms a nice segue, if you will, to this important question that you've asked. And let me jump into this in two different ways. One is it's absolutely true that low-grade geothermal is being utilized in large amounts, and this is very shallow now, in a number of spots around the world and quite extensively in this country in the form of ground source heat pumps.
Right.
And we certainly would encourage that, but we don't feel that is the ground source heat pump issue is something that's going to require a lot of serious new technology that would involve, let's say, a major investment by the federal or a variety of state governments. However, deployment of ground source heat pumps is something that the government on a local level, federal or state level, could intervene with, and because, again, the capital cost of these units is somewhat higher. People who build houses on speculation don't necessarily put in the most energy efficient over the life cycle of the house heat supply or heat supply and air conditioning system, so that some other incentives might work there. But again, if we go a little deeper than just the few meters or shallow depths that we have to for heat pumps, there is an enormous resource that could be utilized much more aggressively and effectively for both combined heat and power, as well as for district heating and other applications. That would involve rethinking in a major way the way in which we provide utilities or energy to homes, as well as large, let's say, large buildings, whether they're industrial buildings or major complexes. In our study, we considered one good example of that. MIT happens to have a cogen plant, combined heat and power plant, that's fairly large. It would be, in fact, in many ways, its size to be compatible with a transfer over to geothermal. Right now, it's fueled with natural gas. It produces about 20 megawatts of electricity, but it also provides all the heating and cooling for MIT's buildings and dormitories, and so we use that as a basis for study. What if we were going to transfer the energy source from natural gas to geothermal? And as you may recall, if you look at the maps that we produced in this study, you have to go very deep if you're going to get the high temperatures on the eastern part of the country, particularly.
It seems like over in the western area, it is much more of the red color.
Right, right. So it's much shallower. So it's but I think once you go to the idea that you're doing heat as well as possibly electricity, the economics begin to look more favorable. You're using a larger fraction of that extracted energy in a useful way. So that makes good sense.
When you drill these holes down into a warm pocket of air or warm pocket of whatever, I would think that as you're pumping it back up to the surface, that the pipe being surrounded by earth for X meters is going to tend to cool it down a lot.
Okay, so now that it's all a matter of how fast you pump through these wells. The typical geothermal well that has a liquid well, let's say, that's producing hot water under pressure would be about 12 inches or so in diameter. And in commercial systems, you're pumping at a very high rate in this well, over 1,000 gallons a minute or so may be typical. And at that rate of pumping, you have a fairly short residence time that the fluid would have in its path from the deep reservoir down below, even if it's a few miles away, up to the surface. So it cools off some, but not very fast. And the very fact that we have heat in place anyways in the earth as a result of the low thermal conductivity of the rock that's underneath our feet, so that this works to our advantage in a sense, and it's actually something you can calculate quite precisely. So a well-designed geothermal system without insulating the pipe in any fancy way would have a few degrees drop in temperature, and you can live with that for sure, because remember, you're producing fluid that might be on a centigrade scale, perhaps 200 to 300 degrees C, and we could double that if we were on a Fahrenheit scale. So a few degrees loss will not be a major issue.
Question, just maybe tangentially, where you're talking about the ground source heat pumps, and traditionally, I have noticed that people refer to that technology as geothermal. I'm wondering if that if you consider that a bit of a misnomer?
Well, I think certainly it really is utilizing an amount of heat. Let me give you an example here. If we, the typical way you might look at this is a so-called coefficient of performance, and what that is a measure of is how much heat is being transferred or in either heating or air conditioning mode relative to the amount of electrical power that's going into these systems. And in a ground source or geothermal type heat pump system, that ratio is 4 to 1 or greater than 4 to 1. So for every unit of electrical power, we're getting 4 units of heat or cooling. Now that energy for heating and cooling has to come from somewhere. And in the heating mode, it's being extracted from the subterranean earth and upgraded via this heat pump idea to where it would be useful at temperatures, say, warming a house. So maybe taking it from something that was 50 degrees Fahrenheit up to 80 or 90 degrees Fahrenheit and utilizing it directly in the house. And likewise, during the summer, when you're reversing the situation, if the subsurface temperature is actually low, lower than the air temperature, then you don't really have to provide much external work or power at all. You're just circulating fluids, if you will, that have been heated in the home and cooling them off underground. So you're right in a way that, you know, the ground source, if it's a true ground source system, it's both accepting heat and, you know, supplying heat at different times of the year. But I think it really can be viewed as a stored energy resource under the ground. You're below the freezing line that you'd have in a normal home. So depending on what part of the country you're on, that'll be at different depths. But it's an extremely effective way to make much better use of electric power.
Right. I'm not arguing about the effectiveness. I guess I'm being a little bit anal in terms of talking about the nomenclature.
Right.
It seems like a more accurate terminology would be a thermal mass principle, whereas a geothermal, you typically think of a heat source, where the earth is actually, you're actually using heat in the earth to provide heat at the surface.
Right. Well, you are using heat in the surface, except you're not using it at that temperature. You're essentially removing, say, a certain number of units of energy and upgrading it using this heat pump cycle. We do the same thing, you know, if you reverse this cycle, the way a refrigerator works, you could argue is the same way. The energy has to come from somewhere. So in this case, it comes from two sources. One is the electric power that's going into powering the heat pump and the earth. If it's an air-to-air heat pump system, if you want to just use that example, then electricity provides the external energy to drive the heat pump, but the actual thermal energy, a good portion of that comes from the outside air. And we warm it up via this heat pump cycle. So I think it's legitimate, but you're right. It operates in a much different way than we run a conventional geothermal system. But in any case, we felt that this was not, you know, really part of, certainly way outside of the idea of EGS. And since the technology is here, it's much more around deployment rather than trying to fund additional research or have additional breakthroughs to occur. These are very reliable systems now. The major heating and ventilating suppliers, such as Carrier and General Electric and a company known as Water Furnace, have been deploying these units for a number of years. So you can get good ones. They're reliable. They have long-term guarantees. And I think we can certainly debate as to whether or not it's a true geothermal source for sure.
Another issue I'd like to ask you about, in Indonesia recently, there was a mud volcano that was released, and it is being blamed on some gas exploration that was being done, drilling about 9,300 feet down, and that has dislodge some 10,000 people from their homes.
Right, it's been
a fiasco. I'm wondering, is that going to be a factor that's going to put a damper on geothermal exploration?
Well, it's interesting you bring up Indonesia. Indonesia is one of the countries that has been developed for geothermal along with the Philippines. It has high-grade natural hydrothermal systems in place, and so they've been producing electric power from one of those. I wasn't aware of any problems, as you're saying, associated with oil and gas production that have had problems in Indonesia, but there are always environmental issues associated with any kind of energy utilization. You're removing fluids that are contained underground under pressure in a natural setting, and so issues such as subsidence and seismicity and things like that have to be looked at carefully, as they would in any kind of subterranean, let's say, mineral extraction, or whether it's minerals in the form of oil and gas or heat in the form of geothermal energy. You're still moving fluids around and changing to some degree the natural state that you have in a well-contained reservoir. So monitoring and management and knowledge about the behavior of these systems is important. And fortunately, the technology for doing that is available, but you have to be cautious about it. Now, what I point out to people when they say, well, there's going to be high environmental risk associated with geothermal because of the examples you're pointing out, we have over a century of experience right now worldwide from the early 1900s in the Lardarello fields of producing geothermal power. Almost all geothermal sites, the natural ones we're talking about, have certain concerns with them. They tend to be seismically active. They tend to be in areas of relatively where you might have active surface manifestations of geothermal. They may be hot springs. It may be even small mud volcanoes or pooling mud or whatever it might be, that because a lot of fluids are being brought close to the surface in a natural way. That's what makes them high-grade geothermal resources. So I guess I would say that that has to be looked at carefully, managed, monitored, and controlled. But we did not see any things that would lead us to believe that we couldn't expand the development of geothermal quite dramatically worldwide and not see dire environmental consequences as a result of that. One beautiful thing about this particular resource, because of its fairly low grade, and what I mean by low here compared to burning fossil fuels on a thermodynamic basis, you have to spread these systems out so that the influence on the subsurface environment is relatively distributed, well distributed, if you will. Good question.
The water that's coming up that's being heated, don't you pump that back down into the ground in a closed loop?
Right. Now, that's something that would certainly be done in the United States, and it would be adopted, I think, in many other countries around the world. But that's a country-by-country issue, and part of it you would do for environmental reasons, for sure, because you would want to make sure that you contain the fluids and maintain the stress state that you have in the subterranean environment. But also part of it might be done for very clear economic reasons or engineering reasons, is that in natural geothermal systems, you would want to recharge that system with water so that it would continue to produce fluids. This is, you know, a technique, obviously, that's used in oil and gas production, where secondary water is injected to maintain the reservoir pressures and maintain production. The same concept is basically true in a natural geothermal reservoir. They learned this the hard way in the geysers field in California, where too much production had occurred. Some of the water there is used for evaporative cooling in the cooling towers and was not reinjected. But now they're reinjecting water from another source. They're actually using treated municipal sewage water as a secondary source of fluid back into the reservoir, quite an ambitious project, and recharging the reservoir in that mode. So water management as well as the other issues we're talking about, has to be done well.
Yeah, I would think that the one of the things I wanted to bring up too, that we've not really talked about yet, is price point. You said in your article that you're anticipating that this geothermal resource tapped would actually meet, if not be lower than what we're currently paying for electricity. Is that based on the present capabilities or in present prices, or is that a projection into possible prices in the future?
Well, there are two parts to this. One is we started the economic study and economic analysis sort of at two levels of detail. One is a complete regional assessment based on the overall EGS resource base and its distribution around the country. And as you can imagine, you would certainly go to areas where the geothermal gradients were high, where you wouldn't have to drill as deep, regardless of whether or not you had a natural system or had to stimulate a system in an EGS mode. That would make a lot of sense because drilling costs are important in any development. So we would start out our regional development of EGS in that manner, but the initial assumptions regarding productivity of the reservoir were really based on, and this is the early, the first few plants, early adoption, if you will, of the technology at a full scale, was based on the numbers for production that we had have achieved at the salt site in Europe already. So we started with what we considered to be existing initial values. These were called base case initial values in the study. And after a period of time, which in our analysis was ranging from maybe 10 to 15 years, and there would be a few of these plants, perhaps five or six, scattered around the country, that we would learn how to do this better. Because even in a plant, even in a single plant, you're drilling multiple wells, you're stimulating those and connecting them. So you're repeating the process of emulating this sort of natural reservoir many times over in a given location. So our thought was that you would get pretty good at this. Typically when you drill one well, you're sort of wildcatting in a certain way, and you learn a lot about what the formation is like and how to drill it better. When you drill a series of wells, your knowledge improves and the cost drop. And when you connect those wells in this subsurface reservoir, our belief is that you'll just get better at it. So we extrapolated then going forward, or projected forward, to what we considered more mature technology after this 10 to 15 year period. And if you and this increases the flow rate by a factor of two or a factor of three or four with a given set of wells. So you don't have to do anything else but improve productivity to bring the cost down, not to a level that anticipates enormous change in U.S. energy markets. In fact, we just used the published figures for the price of electricity during this period. And let me just give you an example of that. If we start today, that number is about 5 cents a kilowatt hour. And even after 15 years, these are in constant year dollars now, so we're taking care of the inflationary aspects. Even in 15 years, that price would not even have reached 6 cents a kilowatt hour for a break-even point. And surely if the dynamic changes in our U.S. energy markets with respect to requiring cleaner coal or tightening down on the availability of natural gas, or if we consider what we're going to do with our existing nuclear reactors, my belief would be that that competitive market price might escalate even faster. But we used what I think is a very conservative, defendable, low price. So after about 15 years, the EGS break-even price with improved productivity, learning by doing, and incorporating new technology that occurred during that 15-year period would be essentially at the existing market price. So that gets back to my earlier comment that after that period, then our thought was that private investors would take this over completely, and there would be no need for further absorbed deployment costs or subsidies or tax credits or whatever you might call it, that it could compete in the evolving U.S. Energy or electricity market.
You were talking earlier about what I would term low-hanging fruit, the hot water that is produced and wasted by oil companies because they don't need it. Is that something that could be tackled almost right away economically?
Well, again, this gets down to the analysis that Dave Blackwell's group at SMU carried out, and we incorporated some of that and reviewed some of the economics. But it's absolutely clear that for a short-term transition, you would do some of that. But that really doesn't develop the EGS reservoir technology. It's just a way of utilizing heat and increasing the fraction of geothermal utilization. It also forms an interesting alliance between oil and gas producers and geothermal producers, which we think would make sense in terms of building relationships going forward with the industry. But it was only one part of our study. We looked at what we called six targets of opportunity for the so-called low-hanging fruit or early deployment. And one of the cases that we considered was a co-produced oil and gas production site. But we also looked at a range of high-grade resources in the western part of the country, including in the Sisters area of Oregon, in Idaho, in Montana, at Clear Lake, California, which is near the Geysers Field, and in the Conway Granite. And this is the only one, the Conway Granite, New Hampshire, this was the only one that was in a much lower grade where the gradients were quite a bit lower. And looking at those, you get a full range of what the cost incentives would have to be to develop that technology early on. And you also appreciate how much those costs come down as you begin to improve reservoir technology. Part of the, I don't want to mislead you to think that this is all about just developing the reservoir. Each one of these cases involves a surface power plant, a conversion plant, where we have to take in steam or hot water and convert it into electricity. Now, the technology for doing that has been around for a while, but it's also improving. It's improving in part because of expanded geothermal deployment, as well as expanded utilization of low-grade heat, low-grade waste heat that comes from other sources. So when you put that on top of better drilling and better productivity from the reservoir, that's when you come up with fairly low costs that could be competitive regionally around the country is going forward to, say, greater than 15 years. Our study carried out a 50-year horizon, which went out to the middle of the century, and the pathway was to get to 100,000 megawatts by 2050. So if you work backwards, what would you have to do now if you really wanted to have the capability of competitive power from EGS to get you to 100,000 megawatts? And again, that goes back to that earlier idea that we wanted to have a large enough impact, at least at a tenth or so of the generating capacity in the country. So similar to nuclear, similar to existing hydro, roughly one-tenth of the terawatt capacity that we have right now in the U.S. that's primarily supplied by coal and natural gas.
Would you say that the plants that are presently in existence are, in the low-hanging fruit analogy, actually fruit that was sitting on the ground? In other words, the geothermal was actually already at the surface, ready to go, and it didn't involve drilling. How would you qualify or rate that in comparison to other energy systems on a competitive playing field?
Okay, well, that's another good question. I think there is this conception that, you know, we just sort of scrape away a few meters of the surface and out comes hot boiling water. Well, it really isn't that simple. Even in the very high grade areas such as what we have in Iceland and the Geysers Field in California, wells are drilled in some cases quite deep, perhaps to 10,000 feet or of the order, let's say, of 10,000 feet, certainly in the 5 to 10,000 foot range. That was true also of the early developments in Italy back in the 1900s and early 1900s, and it's still true today. There are cases where you might not have to drill as deep if you're not necessarily generating electricity and just using the heat for district heating. Iceland provides all of its heating with geothermal. They produce a lot of electricity with hydro and some electricity with geothermal, but they provide all of their heat from geothermal, and those wells would not have to be as deep. But there is a lot of drilling that goes on right now with even the low-hanging fruit, the highest-grade hydrothermal resources that are being developed in the U.S. and in other spots like Indonesia, the Philippines, in Central America, in Mexico. And I think that that is a good thing because when we viewed the industry as it's evolving both nationally and internationally, again, having the capacity to drill, having the infrastructure for providing for power conversion are exactly the sort of things you're going to need for EGF as it expands. So the technologists who are learning their skills deploying and developing these natural hydrothermal systems are trained very well, if you will, to do this other technology at a more aggressive approach. And again, going from the 3,000 megawatts, perhaps we could go to 10,000 or maybe 20,000 megawatts of conventional geothermal in the U.S., and you'd certainly do that where it made sense. But to get to 100,000 or to go much larger than these natural resources, you're going to need EGS. But there's a continuum there from high-grade natural systems to much, much lower-grade EGS systems that you might find in the eastern part of the U.S.
And earlier when you're talking about in this development cycle, establishing 5 to 6 plants in the U.S. to basically learn how to improve the process, I imagine you were describing or thinking of a more substantial commercial plant. How many megawatts would those be each?
Again, we tried not to be too specific about them, but they would certainly not be on the scale of the geysers activity. Looking at the supply curve that we generated, we would probably be talking about tens of megawatts from each one of those sites. And in the development time frame, let me just try to look at this. It would probably be just of the order of a few hundred megawatts of EGS power would be produced by this 10 to 15 year time period that we talked about. Now, that might not seem like a lot, but remember now, this technology, we believe, is very modular. That once you do this at a number of sites and show people that you can reproduce the sort of connectivity and productivity from one site to another, knowing about the geology and drilling the holes down there, then it's logically very expandable from that point. So we really don't produce a lot of power for the first 10 to 15 years, and we have multiple sites, and it isn't until you get to about the 25th year or so that you begin to see much larger plants and much larger developments being put in place. And from 25 to 50 years, of course, there's an enormous growth from about 10,000 megawatts of EGS up to 100,000. And that's not inconceivable, by the way. If we look at the way that we've added gas-fired capacity in this country in the past 15 or 20 years, we've certainly added it at that kind of rate. So we're optimistic that once you show you can demonstrate this, make it modular, and go to a number of sites, that it will be self-sustaining for sure in terms of its growth.
Another question I've got to get in before the end. We need to wrap it up here, but what's the fluctuation like on these plants? How stable are they, and how easy is it to turn up the volume, turn down the volume, let's say, to handle peak loads, and then during the day when you've got lower usage?
Well, most of the geothermal capacity today is used as baseload capacity. Remember, when we're only talking about 3,000 megawatts, so you would use other capacity that you might have for fully dispatchable and bringing power up and down as you needed it. There are concepts that have been looked at for variable geothermal production, and one of the things you can do is you don't want to turn off a well that's producing at a full flow rate for too long. There are lots of issues that you alluded to earlier in terms of the heating and cooling of these wells. If you stop flow in a well for a period of time, that's not necessarily good unless you're planning for it, because the expansion and contraction of the casing is a non-trivial thing when the well is, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 feet deep or deeper, so you have to account for that. But it is done. There have been attempts made at doing this in a time sequence, so-called huff-puff or on-off type geothermal cycles. But if you're going to gradually change flow and still keep flow going through, you know, some modest flow going through the wells, then it is tunable to that kind of degree. Another part of this is that it's not just one well or two wells that are providing the steam or hot water that you need for a power plant. There's a whole field of these wells. So if one happens to misbehave or misperform, you can take it offline, one well, and then bring on a new well if you need to, or increase the flow capacity out of some of the existing wells while you either put repairs in place or rework the subsurface system or drill another well. In all of our economic analysis, we considered that after a period of say, 5 to 10 years at the most, but more likely 5 to 6 years, we would literally re-drill the entire well field and rework the whole system over that period of time. So planned renewal, if you will, of the production is always part of geothermal. But they are baseload facilities, and they're very reliable, as I pointed out. So they're not really true peaking units in that mode. But we need a lot of baseload, too.
Jeff, I appreciate you joining us today. It's been very informative and interesting. Is there a website people can go to kind of get the gist of what you're doing?
Well, the whole report is contained on a couple of websites. I think probably the one that's most active right now is geothermal.inel. That stands for the Idaho Lab. They're the ones that are distributing the report. .gov. So geothermal.inel.gov. But if you also go to the Department of Energy website under the Energy Efficiency Renewable Energy part, the EERE part, you can also get the report. And anyone who doesn't do that, we're going to have it up on the MIT website as well. But you can get access to the shorter report, which has an executive summary and synopsis, or the full report, which is over 450 pages.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thanks a lot for giving me the chance and to tell people a little bit about geothermal, and we hope that this will provide more informed decisions going forward.
Great.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.